Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and earned a journalism degree from Marquette University. After spending 25-plus years in the automotive industry, he opened his own public relations firm in 2005. In 2007, he bought the Whitney, an iconic restaurant in a 118-year-old, 52-room mansion on Woodward Avenue in Detroit. His name, Bud Liebler, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Frasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Our guest tonight, Bud Liebler, is the president of the Liebler Group, a public relations firm. Bud, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Jack, it's a pleasure to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania?
My childhood and my parents. Well, I grew up in the city of Pittsburgh, and I think that's what helped me develop such a love for cities, and it helped me become as involved in Detroit as I ultimately did. Because I saw what could happen to a city. Pittsburgh, at the time when I was growing up, was one of the worst places in the country. It was dirty, it was the old steel city, and there was soot in the air and dirt and slag and everything else. My dad used to have to go to work every day and take a change of shirts so that at noon he would take off his one shirt and tie and put on a different shirt and tie, just because walking through the soot would make it so sooty, make it so dirty. So I sort of watched how Pittsburgh developed over the years as I was a kid growing up there and since. And it has done the city's done a fabulous job, and I believe there's no reason that Detroit can't do just as fabulous a job.
What did you learn, Bud, from your mom, and what did you learn from your dad?
My mom had a great sense of humor. And she was just full of love for everyone. So I think I took that from her. My dad was a very determined guy who was just supportive of everything that I ever tried to do. He believed in me, and I realized how important that is as a parent or as an educator or as a boss or as a colleague, to believe in the people you're working with, because it does help them to believe in themselves and make things happen.
You get a journalism degree from Marquette University. And then you start a career in the automotive industry. How did you ever get into the automotive industry?
Funny story.
Why did you ever?
Funny story. Ford Motor Company came up to Marquette when I was a senior in college, and they were interviewing engineers, but they said they wanted to talk to two journalism students. They wanted to talk to the one who had the highest scholastic average, and they wanted to talk to the president of the class. Well, I didn't have the highest scholastic average, but I was the president of the class. So I had an interview with them, and I should have known right then, because my interview was at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I should have thought right then, oh, wait a minute. Do you really want to get into somebody who wants to see you at 6 o'clock in the morning? Anyway, I had the interview. They brought me to Detroit. I did not get the job. I was the second person. They hired somebody else. I subsequently got a job with a PR firm in Chicago. And 2 weeks after I started that job, Ford called and said, you know, that guy we hired didn't work out. You want to come? And I said, no. I said, I just took a job in Chicago. I can't leave. I just got here 2 weeks ago. So I'm not going to do that. Thank you very much. And then about a year and a half later, they called again. And I said, yeah, I've been thinking about that for a year and a half. I'd love to do it. So that's how I got to Detroit.
So you spent 5 years with Ford Motor Company.
Ten,
I'm sorry. And then you joined Chrysler.
Well, in between, I was at Ross Roy Advertising, which was Chrysler's agency. And when I left Ford, people were scratching their heads. This was in 1976, saying, well, wait a minute. Why would anybody leave Ford Motor Company to go to an agency for Chrysler? And it was just, it was a great opportunity. And it was the people there. Ross Roy was, there was a man named Ross Roy who was running the agency at the time. Well, he wasn't really running it. He was chairman. It was his agency. He was probably 85 years old. But there were good people down there. They had a real need. And I got enthusiastic about it. I liked the opportunity. So I said, okay, I'm coming. And that's how I happened to leave Ford. And Ford was great. I had great experience there. It's a wonderful company. And but I'm happy I made the move I did.
How was it you got to Chrysler?
Well, that was, I became the account supervisor in the Chrysler business. I was at Ross Roy for 3 years, and I was the account supervisor. And at Christmas in 1979, I got a call from my client who said, you know, Bud, he said, I'm not going to make it here. They're going to fire me. He said, it was during the time Chrysler was going after the loan guarantees. And he said, Mr. Iacocca doesn't like me, and I think they're going to get rid of me, and they're going to offer you the job. And I said, oh, no, I'm not so sure I want to do that. I'm not sure I want to go to Chrysler. They don't have the loan guarantees. I'm not sure what that's about. And he said, well, it's probably going to happen. So sure enough, right after Christmas, they called me, and I interviewed with a number of people, most of whom I knew because I was calling on them, but I did not know Mr. Iacocca. And the last interview was with him, and it was for 2.5 hours. And I went home, and I said to my wife, I said, you know what? If I don't have the courage to go to work for that company, I don't see how I can call on them. So I said, one way or another, I either have to leave Ross Roy and go somewhere completely different, or I have to go to Chrysler. And I said, I think I choose to go to Chrysler. And so I did. And it was a fabulous experience. I loved every minute I spent at Chrysler.
You had a lot of ups and downs through those 21 years at Chrysler.
Roller coaster.
What's the biggest thing you learned through those ups and downs?
Well, there are ups after the downs, I guess, and that you just have to, you know, we had an awful lot of criticism at Chrysler. You know, our products weren't right, our people weren't right, our programs weren't right, this wasn't right. But we knew inside what was going on. We knew we were developing K cars at the time. We knew the minivan was coming. We knew we had a new truck line coming. So we just sort of kept our noses to the grindstone. We had a terrific team of people. We had a fabulous team of people. And I think what happened, it was almost like being in war to be at Chrysler, to have gone through the loan guarantees thing and to have these tremendous ups and downs that we had. I mean, the team bonded very well. And people at Chrysler, the executive team, you know, everybody, the vice president of engineering was the vice president of engineering. He didn't try to tell me how to market. I didn't try to tell him how to engineer. But we worked very well together. And it went that way, whether it was design or finance or whatever. There was just a fabulous team of people with a great leader.
We're talking to Bud Liebler. When we come back, we'll ask him, at age 59 in 2001, he was let go by Chrysler, and how he overcame that. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasul, and we're with Bud Liebler, who spent 21 years at Chrysler and Daimler Chrysler, rising to the position of Senior Vice President of Marketing and Communications. Bud, let's go back to February 18th, 2001.
Do we have to? February 18th, 2001, I got a call early in the morning from Dieter Zetsche, who was then running Daimler Chrysler, who I liked very much and admired very much, and had a very good relationship with, and had just spent the previous weekend at his side at the Daytona 500. And he called, and he invited me into his office and closed the door, said, where would you like to sit? I thought, well, that's strange. He never asked me where I wanted to sit before, you know. So I sat wherever I sat, and he said, well, I'm afraid I have some bad news. And I was startled. I was startled. I mean, they had already fired the two presidents, vice chairman, and I think 6 or 7 vice presidents. I didn't think I was going to go because I thought I had a fairly good relationship with them. But he let me go. It wasn't Chrysler who let me go. It was Daimler who let me go. I think it came from Germany. And the rationale at the time was they wanted to start a new marketing program. They didn't want to have incentives anymore. They wanted a whole new look. And Dieter said to me, Bud, he said, I have to tell you, this decision was made before I ever got here. And he had been there 4 or 5 months at the time. And he said, I don't think it's going to go over well internally. But he said, it is what it is. And I said, well, thank you very much. And he was very nice about it. He offered me an office. He said, you can stay here as long as you want. You can keep a secretary. You can, you know, you can have an office if you need it for a year to find something else, whatever. And I said to him, you know what, Dieter, if you don't want me around, I don't want to be around. So I left that week.
You were 59 years old, Bud. How did you get over it?
I'm not over it yet. It really hurt. But how do you get over it? You just live your life and you look around and you say, you know what? I got a lot of good things going on in my life. I have a good wife. I have good children. At the time, I had a couple grandchildren. I have more now. And I thought there were opportunities. I was very involved in the city of Detroit. I was on several boards and still am, cultural boards. And I was deeply involved with them and I cared a lot about them. And I thought, well, I have some more time. And interestingly, my father had gotten ill. He had cancer, and that year in particular was tough. He was still in Pittsburgh, and my wife and I were building a house. So, I mean, I had things to do to keep busy. I was going back and forth to Pittsburgh to see my dad. We were managing the construction of this house. I was staying on my boards here, and I actually started to write a novel, which to this point is still sitting on my desk somewhere. But that's how I essentially got over it, but I didn't really ever get over it. That's not the way I wanted to leave Chrysler.
If there's a listener tonight, he's 55 years old, she's 55 years old, and has just been let go. And she says, I'm angry, I'm depressed, but I'm terrified. I got 3 kids in college. What do you say to that person?
Well, I think you have to let the hurt, I think you have to acknowledge the pain. And let it get through you and then just rise above it and look around and see what other opportunities there are, because there are other opportunities there out there. There's life after Chrysler. There's life after being president of the United States. I don't think Bill Clinton liked giving up the office after 8 years, but he's had a pretty decent life and he's made some pretty significant contributions. And I think you can do that. It is very difficult when you've got kids and you're worried about educating them and that kind of thing. You got to find a job. So the stress is huge. I was fortunately out of that. I mean, my kids were educated and married by the time this happened to me. Plus, I had a pension, better pension then than I have now. But it was, for me, it wasn't bleak. It was just, I was hurt. I was hurt by it. That's the part that was tough to get over. I think I'm over the hurt now. It's not the way I wanted, as I say, to end my career.
Nancy helped you through it. Oh. What can and what should a spouse do when a mate loses a job?
Well, I'm fortunate. Nancy, first of all, she's a psychologist. So she understands these things, and she knew how to talk to me and how to listen. And I think, you know, you have to vent a little bit and you have to be morose a little bit and then you just have to get on with it. And I think that's what she said to me. Hey, I think she was probably the one who pointed out, you know, she supported me. She said, I understand your pain. I understand why you feel badly about this. But, you know, you've got so many good things in your life. Look around and see what they are and do something with them. So she was extremely supportive, did not push too hard, knew when to push and knew when to back off.
In 2005, you start the Liebler Group, a public relations firm. Tell us about the Liebler Group.
Well, we actually had started earlier. I had a partner, Bruce McDonald, and we had started out in Rochester Hills. We were actually Birmingham, and then we were in Rochester Hills. And we started the Liebler Group when we moved downtown to the with the public relations company. And it was just that public relations was what I had done. I had done a combination of PR and marketing my whole career. And I really believed in the value of the PR. I really thought that PR had something to offer and that we could do something with it and that we could get ourselves some clients and help them along the way. So that's how we started it. And I brought my son into the business with me, which was fabulous. He, too, had been working at Chrysler. He wasn't particularly happy with all the changes at Chrysler. I mean, when they went from being Chrysler to being Daimler Chrysler to being Cerberus, there was so much change. And during that 8 or 9 year period, the company wasn't putting money into product. It was a Wall Street, you know, the Cerberus thing was a Wall Street company. They were not an automotive company. They weren't investing back into the company. There were management changes every third day. And so my son wasn't particularly happy there. I think a lot of the Chrysler employees weren't happy. The Chrysler employees have lived through a lot the last 10 years. So it's really wonderful and rewarding to see that what's happening there now with Sergio and the Fiat relationship.
You have a monthly newsletter.
Yes.
Entitled News from the D.
Yep.
What's the theme? Why are you doing it? And how can we learn more?
Well, the theme, my wife said to me recently, she said, why do you vent so much? And I said, well, because there's so much to vent about. I said, you know, this city, I love this city to death, but it drives me crazy to death, too. You know, we have, if you go back a couple of years, we had all the problems with Kwame and all that kind of stuff. Now we've got the problems with, Wayne County. And, you know, we sometimes can't get out of our own way. There's so many people trying so hard. Mayor Bing is trying hard. I think the new city council is a huge improvement over former city councils. But we still have a lot of infighting going on. I mean, this is the whole issue with the bridge. I mean, and why can't we get this M1 line? Here the Secretary of Transportation comes into Detroit, and he says, oh, I can't give you $25 million for the M1 line because you need to show that you can provide the rest of the fund and manage it. But here's $20 million for the bicycle path, which is great. The DeQuinder cut is fabulous. But I think we need the M1 line down Woodward Avenue even more, and I don't know why we can't get it. Why do we have all? And you got guys like Carmanos and Illich and Dan Gilbert and Roger Penske putting up their own money and working like crazy, and Matt Cullen working like crazy to get that M1 line started. And everywhere these light rail lines have gone, they have increased business and brought people into the city. That's what we need to do. We need to bring people into this city to make it what it can be and what it used to be. It's not going to be what it used to be. It's not going to be a city of 2 million people, but it can be just as good.
We're talking to Bud Liebler, who in 2007 bought the Whitney. When we come back, we'll ask him, why did you ever buy the Whitney? And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Bud Liebler, who in 2007 buys the Whitney, an iconic restaurant in a 118-year-old, 52-room mansion on Woodward Avenue in Detroit. Why?
My wife asked me that question 7 times a week. You know, I bought it with my heart, not with my brain. And why I bought it, truly, I was looking for office space for the business downtown, and I wanted to own something. I'd been down here, as I said, I've been on these boards for years, and I thought, I want to make a commitment. I want to own something. I don't want to rent space. I'm not Dan Gilbert, but I want to own something. And I wanted to invest some money in the city, number one. Number two, I wanted to preserve a piece of architecture in Detroit, because so much of Detroit has either fallen to the wrecking ball or, worse yet, just been allowed to fall apart and deteriorate. And we had so much fabulous, fabulous architecture in this city. And there's so little of it left now, whether it's office buildings or some of the beautiful homes that we had and still have along Boston Boulevard, Boston Edison, and over in Indian Village and places like that. But too much of our architecture, which is our history, has just been destroyed. And here comes this building that I found that I could actually buy. I could afford to buy it, I thought, before the recession and all that sort of thing. But it was something I thought I could afford to do. It would be a good thing for the city. It would be a good thing for my soul. And also, I fell in love with the carriage house behind the Whitney. I don't know if you've ever even noticed it, but there's a 6,000 square foot carriage house back there. It still has the original stables in it. It still has, David Whitney had a lot of money, of course, and he had winter and summer carriages, and they had an elevator in there, which they hoisted up. And that elevator, it's just a floor that the carriage went in on. They put the winter one upstairs for the summer, and the summer one came down. And now all that equipment's there, and it's just a really special space. And I thought, well, this would really be cool. I could buy the restaurant, then I could put some money into the carriage house and have my office there and rent out some space for others. Well, unfortunately, the restaurant took all the money. And there was more to do when I got in there than I realized. I mean, heating and ventilation and cleaning up the kitchen, just cleaning up the place in general. It had deteriorated over the years. You know, Dick Kuhn had bought it and made it a restaurant back in 1986 and had poured a ton of money into it. He's the one who really invested to make it a restaurant in the first place. But, you know, it was 20 years later and it needed to be cleaned up and perked up. So I had to do that. And that's a long answer to your question, why? But that is the real reason why. And I'm still, it's been a tough haul, but I'm still glad the restaurant's standing, and I'm still glad it's open to the public, and people can go in it and enjoy it, and it's a part of history, of Detroit's history that's preserved.
Tell us a little bit about David Whitney.
David Whitney was a lumber baron. He came here from Massachusetts. He had three or four older brothers, and the father had worked for them back in Massachusetts, but he said to David, I think I've run out of jobs. Why don't you go out to Michigan and make your fortune? So David came out here and had lumber fields in all over northern Michigan, all over the state of Michigan, Ohio, and Oregon. And he lived down in Brush Park. And then before he built the home that's now the Whitney Restaurant, he built that in the years 1890 to 94. And he actually only lived there about a year before he died. And then his widow lived there, and she stayed on and raised her children there and stayed until the 20s. But David Whitney Jr., his son then, became very active also in the city. He ran, I don't know whether it was a homeless shelter or what it was. I think it was a homeless shelter. And he had something they called the Thursday Lunch Club, not at the Whitney Restaurant, but at different places where that he brought together. And they met once or twice a month on Thursdays to discuss the issues of the day, you know, whether it was police issues or political issues or crime or sports or whatever. I mean, the same exact things we're discussing today, he was discussing. And I think that sort of in the back of my mind starts this news from the D and why am I writing this column? And that's only for clients. But David Whitney was active. His kids, his daughters went on to be very generous with their money. And, of course, the Whitney money eventually went to start the McGregor Foundation, which is still, I think it's a, I don't know, $150 million foundation. It's doing great things for the city of Detroit and beyond. So David was a good guy, and I think following in his footsteps, even in a small way, is a good thing.
We're talking to Bud Liebler. Bud, running any business today is very tough. Running a successful restaurant is extremely tough. Yogi Berra has a lot of lines. One is, it's a funny thing about baseball fans. If they don't want to come to the games, you can't stop them. True in restaurants, too.
Yeah.
What's the key to having a successful restaurant?
Well, I think for most restaurants, it's great food and service. I think we have an added plus because we have such a unique venue. And we've become very much a special events place. We've tried to broaden it to get more people in to just say, come for lunch, come for dinner, which they do. They do more than they ever have in the past, I think. But we do an awful lot of weddings and anniversaries and graduations and family celebrations. And it's because the place, it's an authentic Detroit place. I mean, authenticity has become a big word. And I think authentic Detroit is a big concept. And this house is an authentic Detroit house, and it's a beautiful place. So you're not going to go anywhere else and have dinner in those kind of surroundings. And I think we've coupled it now with very good food, outstanding food, and very good service. So that's to me the quote-unquote secret of running a successful restaurant. It has been difficult the last several years to have a higher-end restaurant in Detroit with all the problems Detroit has had, but we feel like we're coming back strong, and we're feeling pretty good about where we are. And feeling very good, by the way, about Midtown. Midtown Detroit is a very exciting place to be. And if I could be anywhere with this restaurant, I think that's where I'd choose to be.
You mentioned the secret. Most people meet you and they think you're 50, 55 years old. You're 70.
Shh.
You've got a tremendous childlike wonder and outlook on life. If somebody's out there listening and said, I'm 50 and I've lost that, Bud Liebler, how do I get that back?
Well, I think you get it from within. You don't get it from outside. It's inside you. And, I think you are a product of everything you've seen, done, eaten, touched in your whole life. And it starts, you know, with what did your parents put into you? What did your teachers put into you? What did your friends put into you? What did your colleagues put into you? What did maybe some of the people you didn't like, some of the things you saw that you didn't like, teach you that you didn't want to do? I don't think it's something that you develop overnight. I don't think that what I've developed is in any way unique. But I do think that there are times you have to go into yourself and just sort of, you know, I don't know what the word is. I'm thinking pull yourself up by the bootstraps, but it's an internal pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. And to me, you just got to be constantly aware of that, of who you are, and be who you are. Don't be who someone else wants you to be. Be who you are and say what you believe. And I think, you know, every morning you get up, that's, people say it all, that you got to look yourself in the mirror and you got to like what you see. And I think that's the way I try to live my life. And if you don't like what you see some morning, then you better figure out how to fix it.
You're a great booster, by your own admission, of the city of Detroit. What do you see in Detroit that many other people who live outside the city don't see?
Oh, man, I see people who love the city like I do. I see people who really, really care about the city, who want it to come back, who desperately want it to come back, and are very, very proud to be called Detroiters. I live in Bloomfield Hills, but if I travel, I don't tell people I live in Bloomfield. Where are you from? I'm from Detroit, and I'm proud of it, and I'm getting prouder by the day. I mean, as things change, it is definitely getting better, and the things Dan Gilbert's doing downtown are definitely helping it to get better, and the arts community that's growing so fast around here is a terrific thing, and the entrepreneurial community that's coming into Detroit, and the people who are trying to start new small companies, and I think there's tremendous excitement here. I tell young people all the time, especially young guys, but young guys and girls, that, you know, you can go to Chicago. Chicago is still my favorite city in the country. And New York, to me, is the most exciting. Chicago is the best overall place to live. And Detroit isn't either one of those. But I think now Detroit has opportunity that Chicago and New York can't offer. And it's opportunity for young people to truly make a difference, to come here and do something and be noticed and get more responsibility here than they might get somewhere else, and really hopefully stay and feel very good about what they're doing and grow up with this community, because this community is going to grow up again.
We're talking to Bud Liebler. When we come back, we'll ask him about the rebirth of Midtown. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Bud Liebler, president of the Liebler Group, a public relations firm. But we hear all this great stuff about downtown, but not as much about the rebirth of Midtown.
Well, actually, Midtown's rebirth is almost leading downtown's rebirth, I think. There's a woman named Sue Mosey who runs Midtown Detroit, Inc. I call her the mayor of Midtown. And this is a woman who's been here in Midtown for about 25 years. 22 of those years, nobody noticed. I mean, I think they noticed her because she's a powerhouse. But if you think about Midtown and you think of the area that it encompasses, including what used to be called the Cass Corridor, and you remember Cass Corridor, you wouldn't go there. You'd be taking your life in your hands 25 years ago. Well, now it's being gentrified. I mean, Wayne State University is doing fabulous things and building new buildings. There's new small businesses coming in there. You know, there's a new K9 to 5 baby dog sitting place. There's a hair salon. There's three new shops opening right at the corner of Canfield. One's blocked down from Canfield. There's a new apartment building right at the corner of Canfield and Cass. It's going to have 54 units and 13 units of retail. There's a building a half block down there on Canfield that was a rental that's turning into a condo building that's selling quickly. There are art galleries opening. George Namdi's art gallery in the whole Sugar Hill district right there by MOCAD. And MOCAD has got plans to do some expansion. There are more and more people moving into Midtown. We have the Live Midtown program to encourage people to move in, to incentivize them to move in. So the the physical look of the place is incredible. Just we're doing some work for a new advertising agency. It's called Jackson and Partners, which just moved from Las Vegas to set up headquarters in Midtown Detroit. And they're doing it because they're located right between Wayne State University and the College for Creative Studies. And they say, where better to go for young creative talent? And they want to do, they do automotive work there. They come from an automotive background. Where better to be than Detroit, Michigan? So Midtown and restaurants, it's not just the Whitney. There are other new restaurants. Just opened the Great Lakes Coffee Shop down on Woodward. There's an old theater, I think it was called the Garden Theater Building, on Woodward, just up from the DSO, which is being completely redone, a 32,000-square-foot theater. There's a new five-story building going up on the corner there at Shelby. I mean, there's a lot happening every day, and it's just exciting to be
the
around.
The president of Wayne State University, a longtime friend?
Yes.
Alan Gilmore.
Alan Gilmore, the fact that he came out of retirement to take on the task of running Wayne State University is one of the best things I think that's ever happened to Wayne State University. Alan is a guy I worked with for 3 or 4 years at Ford, and I would tell you he's the smartest guy I ever worked with. And he's also, his heart is in the right place. He's giving his all to Wayne State. And, well, Wayne State just announced a couple months ago this new, I think it's a biomedical building they're going to build on Woodward. $90 million, $93 million project that they're taking on. The Wayne State doesn't get the credit, I don't think, that it deserves. It is a huge university, and it has a real campus. You know, you get in off Woodward, and you go in there, and they've got some beautiful architecture. They've got great programs. They've got a great new engineering school, new medical school program, big medical school. And they're very actively involved. Wayne State, Henry Ford Health System, Henry Ford Hospital, the Detroit Medical Center. Those are three great anchor institutions that are helping to build Midtown. And then throw on top of that, you've got the Detroit Symphony, the Detroit Institute of Arts, the Charles Wright Museum of African American History, the Detroit Science Center, which is going to reopen, the Detroit Public Library, the Detroit Historical Museum, which is having a remake right now. They're closed for 6 months until November. The Scarab Club. I mean, everywhere you look, the Shelby, the Shelton, Park Shelton Hotel, former hotel, is now apartments. I think it's pretty much completely leased, and there's new retail and restaurants down below. I mean, suburban people need to get back here and give Detroit a chance.
We've had a lot of great leaders in this town. One that you worked with was Lee Iacocca.
Well, Lee's my hero. He was the most charismatic guy I've ever seen. I mean, when we all worked at Chrysler, I think we would have walked through walls for him. And the reason was that he was walking through them himself. And people, you know, for years I used to say, we're not selling K cars or Dodges, we're selling Iacoccas, because he was the one who brought credibility to the company during those years in the early 80s. He single-handedly saved the company in the 80s. And then I think in the early 90s, he was smart enough to say, well, it's not me anymore, and he turned it over to Bob Lutz and people like that to do the product development and allow it to happen and encourage it to happen and to lead it on. Lee had a gut instinct, a great, I believe, gut instinct for knowing what the man on the street wanted to hear. And he said it. He was honest as the day is long. And if he screwed up, he admitted he screwed up.
He was able to capture the hearts of the people.
Oh, absolutely.
And we have another leader here today, Ellen Mullally, who has transformed that Ford Motor Company. How has he done it?
You know, I don't know Alan Mullally. I read about him, and I have met him. He is a very personable guy who obviously doesn't take a lot of gruff from anybody. And he had a vision, I believe, when he went into Ford. I think he saw the politics that existed formerly at Ford and said, no, we're not going to have that anymore. Everyone is going to do his or her own job, and we are going to work together as a team. And we're going to have one Ford. That was his line, the whole one Ford thing. He is a gentleman. He seems to treat everybody equally the same way. I mean, my impression is he treats the man on the line as same as he treats his executives. And I think he somehow, I don't know how he did it as fast as he did. I think he came from Boeing with an understanding of what needed to be done at Ford, and he has tackled it and done it extraordinarily well.
Our own Mitch Albom, a year ago, wrote a play, one-man play, entitled Ernie.
Yep.
You recently went to see it on Ernie Harwell.
It was terrific, too.
It's maybe the most beloved man in the history of Michigan.
I think that's very possibly true. I still miss him. I still miss him. I mean, we've had some great sports and other broadcasters in the meantime, but Ernie was a one of a kind. And Ernie's reputation and Ernie, I think the reality of Ernie was that he was such a people person. The stories about Ernie are legion about how he went out of his way to just be kind to other people because he was bigger than life. And, you know, Ernie was spring around here and, you know, the winters can be long and you relish when spring comes. And all it took was to hear Ernie in that poem about the turtle. And you knew summer was coming and baseball was coming and everything's going to be all right. Ernie was a fabulous, fabulous person. And the play is wonderful. It brings it all back.
He used to always say, whenever you have the choice of being right or kind, always choose kind.
Well, I think he did. And, you know, in the play, there's a couple scenes about and where he talks about Lulu, his wife, his widow, who was a beautiful woman, by the way. They have pictures of her when she was a younger woman, and she's just a beautiful woman. But the line I think I liked best in the play was when the boy asks Ernie's talking about marrying Lulu and going on his honeymoon, and he says to Ernie, well, how was your honeymoon? And Ernie said, I'll let you know when it's over. And he had been married 67 or 68 years at the time. Well, if you can live life like that, you know, that means you're going to live a pretty good life. Because if everything's okay, you know, as they say, if mama don't like it, you know, nothing's any good or something, whatever it is. Well, I think he and mama liked everything together, and they made their life great.
As our time winds down together tonight, last question, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
Give Detroit a chance. Give Michigan a chance. We have been through the toughest times. We've been through the bottom. I think we've come out. I think the opportunity here for young people is beyond maybe anything they could achieve anywhere else. An opportunity to make a difference, to really do something that's important, and to live a good life as a result. Michigan people are good people, and there's nothing wrong with being from Michigan. In fact, everything's right with being from Michigan, and I think we need more young people to stay here and help us do it.
Bud Liebler, you're a world-class salesman for Detroit, and more importantly, for life.
Thank you.
Thanks. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.